matters that are going on in Bristol now. Concerns Castle Park in the centre of Bristol, about which there is much history, but is the subject of a current campaign by developers to develop it and by users to maintain it. The speaker we have today is Mary Bannerman, who is the main applicant on the application to the City Council to register Castle Park as a town green. I'd like to welcome her here to speak to the group. Thank you very much.
Hello everybody, and I'd like to thank you very much for asking me to talk tonight. First of all, Dan's wrong in saying that I'm not going to do any history. I have got some history. But first of all, I'd like to introduce Castle Park. That's it. Obviously, you may be some outsiders, you may not know. There it is, right in the middle. Deppelmead Station there, the gallery's here. It is not a historic common, historically. It is different from the other ones in that this was, in fact, the historic centre of power of Bristol. It falls into two parts. To the east, there is the castle site, and to the west is the original Saxon settlement of Bristol, the one that we hear is called Brigstow, placed by the bridge and all that. So the settlement is not recorded, it is recorded from Saxon times. The castle is Norman. So they sat together on that piece of green land for a very long time. There are two sets of walls involved here, which is quite interesting, which you need to remember for later. The castle area wall down there, and the line of the old city wall was also through the middle, but they're on either side of St. Peter's. The line of the castle wall was to the east of St. Peter's at the end of that bit of water garden and stuff on the steps. And the original line of the city wall actually went through the present site of St. Peter's. Whether they were there simultaneously, I don't know. Most of the history I've got actually applies to the castle part, because it was much more eventful than just being a little settlement and a set of shops and all the rest of it. And my history mostly comes from Latimer's Annals of Bristol. There was a Charter 19 in 1629, in which we learn that Edward III, in the 47th year of his reign, made Bristol separate from Gloucester and a county in itself. That's fine, but it didn't include the castle. And by 1611, the castle, which was in Bristol, but exempt from its civic jurisdiction, had fallen, become absolute shambles, and was a refuge for anybody who wanted to get away from the powers of being Bristol. In 1626, Charles I made it part of Bristol, so that the ragtag and bobtail that lurked in the castle actually began to get the same rights as the citizens of Bristol. 3 years later, one Sir Thomas Fanshawe recorded that the ruins of the castle are exceedingly great. The precincts are covered with little cottages piled on the head of one another. Rather a nice vision of the remains of the castle with all these little buildings all over it. And a year later, for divers good reasons, the city of Bristol purchased the castle from the Crown. 4 years later, it was almost quite demolished, I quote, but only to be rebuilt a few years later and fortified for the Royalist cause in the English Civil War, which of course the Royalists lost. And by 1656, the castle was finally demolished, and the stone was used to build Old Market. Interestingly enough, the moat remained for another 200 years and wasn't filled in until 1847, when it was finally filled in, and it's the line of it, of the moat, is Lower Castle Street. There's much less information at all about the western end, the city end. From the earliest times, it was a commercial area, and over the centuries, the whole area was built over. and became the solid centre of Bristol. There was no green space there. Then, our good friends the Germans, there was the Blitz and major airstrikes on the 24th of November 1940, again in January, and again in August 1942. And the whole place was devastated. Wasn't completely devastated. There were a certain number of buildings that did survive, but the image we are sold today is that it was flattened by enemy action. The council purchased the whole area, mostly in a compulsory purchase order in 1946, and some more of it later in 1950, for quite substantial sums of money were spent to buy, by the council, to buy these, all the whole property of that green area. Some of you will notice that, of course, the City of Bristol has bought this area twice. So there is very little doubt that actually the council does own Castle Park. And the city was not rebuilt. They bought this area up. There were various plans. In 1966, the City Centre Policy Report had made a very substantial proposal which involved a park to the eastern end on the Castle Park area up to the former castle wall, and what is considered a civic area to the west on the old city area, again up to the city wall. And the civic centre was to include an art gallery and a museum and all these splendid buildings. Interestingly enough, actually, they had already sold and had already by that time built the bank building and the Norwich Union building. So they hired Sir Hugh Casson, and they had a really very nice plan for an excellent park, but they ran out of money. And they ran out of, so in the original plan for the park was 1971 and 72. By 1978, they haven't achieved it, but they have opened the whole area as a park. And I think you can see just that there's a bit here that's a paler green, and that I think is the area covered by the St Mary's Port, the Bank House, and the Norwich Union Building, and the Norwich Union's car park. Having talked briefly of the history, what of the future? We really don't know. The user group, of which I'm a member, was founded in 2006 with a view to opposing the redevelopment of the whole area between High Street and St Peter's. I'm much indebted to Bob Drummond, to some of you who may know, who pointed it out to me in the first place, and also guided my early research efforts, and she gave us some useful references. We therefore decided to make an application for the whole area, to be a town green. This St Peter's, this St Mary's Port here, and this including everything that is not currently built on. And that is the statement that we made in our application, that it was for Greater Castle Park, which included all of it, except what was built on it. There are lots of reasons for it to remain a green. It's been used, although it's not a common in the accepted sense of the word, it has been used by Bristolians in large numbers for over 20 years. We managed to find 30 inhabitants in the area who had used it for more than 20 years. Actually, because so few people live in this area, the definition under the 1960s Act, in terms concerning village and town greens, was very difficult to meet. we actually realised that it was going to be very difficult to make it go under the older legislation and delayed it until the new legislation came in. It might be a little bit better, I'm not sure. We'll see about talk about that in a moment. The other thing, the key point is, of course, that the main users of the park in the week are workers, not people that live there. It's a difficult one, this, because a lot of the people who've used the area for a very long time have now actually moved or been moved out of the city centre. So, however, they are there, but they're not perhaps the most powerful arm of our argument. It's used today by thousands of workers in the Lancashire, particularly in the Western End. At the weekends, you find a different population there, their families with children. It's an essential recreation for an area which has increasing numbers of workers and increasingly residential area. So the requirement, the need for it, is getting greater, not less. Now, to make my point, I've got four slides, which was a map, maps at the back, outlining the area of Bristol. This is how it looked in 1817. At this stage, it's not terribly clear. Maybe we'll have to go and look at it in the back. And at this stage, the northern boundary was Montpellier, and the southern was the newly built Coronation Road. No buildings south of Coronation Road, and Redland was an isolated village. And then we move on. Next one, please. Is 1897. This is post-industrial revolution. It's spread a lot, it's very solid. And again, 1919, it's getting even bigger. A different style of mapping here. This is the Ordnance Survey's new type of mapping. So you do get a different impression there. And then finally today, when we fill the whole frame, and I don't know how well you can see, there is a tiny little big blotch somewhere here. No, you can't see it. I'm sorry, it's not, at least I can't see it. Tiny little bit in the middle of there is Castle Park. When the city was smaller, one could easily reach the outside, get out into the country in quarter of an hour, 20 minutes walk. Obviously, that is now quite impossible. Bob Drummond set up a petition in 2006, which was presented to the council with 5,000 signatures objecting to the development of the area. We followed this up with an in-depth investigation onto the use of it in November and December 2006. And in the depths of winter, we raised nearly over 3,000 signatures from people who were actually using the park in November and December 2006. This could be said to repeat the process that was made in 1961 when the council sold the sites for development for the bank and the Norwich Union building. At that point, they got 10,000 signatures. I have to presume it was someone. So we went ahead under the new legislation to present an application, which went into the council on the 17th of January this year, and objections had to be registered by the 18th. We had a total of 7 objections, which doesn't seem very many. One of them, of course, was Bristol County Council, Bristol City Council, which I received on the 17th. And it was a very fair and very fully documented account. This is valuable because when we went to the record office to look for documents, they were not there because they had been taken from the record office to legal services in connection with the development of Broadmead, and they hadn't come back in. So when we got our finally got our fully documented set of stuff from Bristol City Council, it did contain most of the documents we would have liked to have seen much earlier. So that leaves us with six other objections. One was written by one man in two hats. One was the master of Old St. Stephen's Ringers, and the same man, same address, FRCS, FRSA, writing an identical letter to the other one, which was also exactly the same as two of the others we got. They were all, with the exception of the Ringers, the master of the St. Stephen's Ringers, from people who have a major commercial interest in this place. This also was quite valuable because we didn't actually know, hadn't always been able to find out who actually owned or who the business interests were. Because you may say it's owned by the Norwich Union, but who controls the Norwich Union? And so we now have letters from all the commercial parties or their legal representatives. Legally, there are three objections, as far as I can see. Out of those seven, there are three main objections. The first is that it cannot be agreed because it's already a park. And this is a difficult one, but we do not know, actually, it seems a little strange that we don't know the boundaries of the legal park. If you get a map from Bristol City Council's Parks and Gardens Department, it shows the whole of the area as parkland. But is this a management matter? Or is the area of actual, legally genuine park that was set in 1970, 71, 72 within the old castle site, leaving the western end, which is a bit we're worried about, still perhaps open space, but just possibly not park. We're picking down spare brains over that one. The original plan for development was put up in a consultation in 2006 with an extraordinarily biased way. We had four options and they gave no information about the first three. The last one we had to accept because it was necessary that we did this one to provide capital for looking after the rest of the park. It was very persuasive. For a little while I almost believed it, and then I suddenly thought, hey, this is a con, and I've been pretty annoyed by it ever since. Basically, we now wait. We've got until the 23rd of May to answer these objections. I don't know how much of a show of it we'll make. I don't know whether we'll succeed. As part of a concerted effort in other directions, it may help. It's undoubtedly caused delay. It's undoubtedly got the right documents coming to light. And we undoubtedly now know who we're actually dealing with. Whether in combination with the consultation on the use of open green spaces, even if it fails, we can cause yet further delay, I'm not sure. But if we respond at the end of May and then an inspector has to be appointed 2 months more, at least we have caused the developers to waste nearly another year. And maybe in small measure that's a success. But we do not really know where we're going now. I hope Dan does.
Hello. Just like a little contribution.
Yes, please.
Because of the way the consultation process was presented to people in 2006, people's perception, including mine, of what the plans were, was very vague. And over the year and a half since that we've been leafleting and collecting signatures in the park, lots of people have been astounded to hear that there's a plan to develop the park. They haven't been told. They don't know it. And the council, doing a rather familiar trick by now, kind of told people about a year ago, I think, that all plans were on the shelf indefinitely.
Yes,
and they realised that people didn't want the park developed, and that they were going to leave all the green space and we could all forget about it. This is a familiar thing that they
do to
try and head off any public alarm or any kind of unified response. And George Bergeson, who is supposed to be everybody's friend and a great public figure, is working with the developers, Dealey Freed, to come up with another plan, which is supposed to be revealed around about Christmas, but we haven't heard anything about it yet. And we're still waiting to find out what they do envisage. It's probably some kind of combination of the previous plans. It involves probably a building down to the bridge and taking away all the avenue of cherry trees and everything up to the diagonal path.
Well, he was going to consult with us.
And there is unspecified things for the rest of the park. Now, it's very important that we get it across to people that they do intend to go ahead and develop it, and just a kind of rather tentative legal challenge on its own is not going to stop it. We need a whole lot more than that.
It is incredibly difficult to keep a protest group going.
Well, not just the protest group, but the public awareness of it.
Well, yes, that's a major issue.
You thought of a request under the Freedom of Information Act for... A request under the Freedom of Information Act for those plans.
Well, I'm not sure it's impossible to find out. It's rather that the kind of things that we have been trying to find out seem to be so obscure and technical that we're still not quite sure exactly what it is. Whether a park has to have some place that it's officially registered as a park for us to be able to say that it is not fully recognised as a park and it could be a town green. We don't know. I mean, it was apparently declared a park in 1978. But somebody else said in 1993 or something it had a different status, or because of some development.
Oh, yes,
you know, the castle site.
I had forgotten one thing, just reminded me, Richard. The third objection that they were making was that while the gallows was being built, the castle park had been used as a car park for 500 cars, and therefore we cannot claim continuity of use.
I really don't understand that.
Also, they got the dates wrong.
Right. So we could challenge all of these things initially.
Also, thank you for your question. Because you're laughing about it being temporarily used as car parking space while the galleries are being built.
Yes.
I believe in the legislation that was the application of a town green, it says. That this is on a permanent basis and no temporary closure, i.e. like a temporary fence put up while they reseed the grass or anything like that. It's basically, that was a temporary measure.
This is what I understood, but the objectors obviously made it clear that they didn't see it that way. Yeah. But I think the car park objection is probably the least of our troubles. Wouldn't you agree, Dan?
Well, it's something that we can challenge. It's something that they have raised as an objection to our town green application, and if it's such a kind of futile point, then we ought to point that out. We ought to say that's not a real objection.
Mm.
This park isn't basically a park can't become green, George.
That's correct. Yes.
So that pretty much implies everywhere in Bristol where things grow.
The point is this: the point is whether you're using the lands as a squatter would use a house. You're just using it, or whether you're using the lands with the landowner's permission. Now, parklands with bylaws and gates and fences, which you're allowed in at sunrise and you're allowed out at sunset, is used under licence. Scrublands, which people just play on, is used as of right.
Mm.
What we have here is something which is in the middle, and there's been the most recent case is a similar area of land in Sunderland, which is a bit less parkish than this, but nevertheless the council mowed the grass, they put up lights, they put out benches, and they actively encouraged people to use it. But the House of Lords said, well, that doesn't make it a park. People were still using it just because they wanted to, and you couldn't stop them. And so they succeeded in registering that land in Sunderland as a town green. Now, what the council's not done here is register it as a park. There's no park bylaws. There's absolutely no restriction on access at any time of day. There's nothing to indicate that this is a park in the traditional sense of the word. They've simply called it a park.
Yes, yes.
And
that used to be called Parcel Green.
And the council could register it as a green itself, though, couldn't it?
Yeah, but then they couldn't develop. Bizarrely, if it's a parkland, if they succeed in showing that it's park, they can develop it. But if it's green, they can't.
Can you shed any light on this thing about the ownership? Where the council has always tried to say, oh goodness, yes, we'd like to keep it, but actually part of it belongs to the Morley Pension Fund and we have to consider them. Or it's on a lease or something.
It's on a lease. It's leasehold. Leasehold for 100 years. Right. But one of our objectors was from the owner of the buildings of the bank house, who were pretty tart in their objections because they are cooperating with Dealey Friend in the plans for the development.
Right. But that really they really objected only about the car park, the bit of the car park by that building
yes.
as being included.
One would actually like those hideous buildings redeveloped. So one doesn't
want... No, not that.
Thank you.
That's green space.
Not with a block 6 or 7 stories high, which is what some of the...
But the limits of their land is the edge of the car park, and that's pretty much what they've told us in their objection, that the buildings are subject to lease, and the car park around the buildings where they park their cars are subject to that lease, but beyond that, it's all
just the bit that concerns me most is the bit between the Norwich Union and the floating harbour, because there have been plans before for a substantial building right across, so when you come over the bridge, and if you look to your right, look down through the park, all you would see would be an enormous block. Now this has almost been passed, almost happened before, and one is a little concerned that it will happen again. Possibly the economic downturn will act in our favour, I don't know.
Again, this is another part of the irony, is that if the land is zoned for development, but not developed for 20 years, and the public effectively squat it for recreation for 20 years, then that's our strongest case.
Oh, I didn't know that.
the less they permit people to use it, the stronger the case is.
Yes.
What about
St Mary Le Port, which they recently put up railings there?
Yeah, there's less
to keep people out of the church building, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's to stop people sleeping there or spraying.
Yeah.
Can we bring any kind of pressure on the developers to release or to give out some kind of information about what their current plans are? Because at the moment they're keeping so quiet because they hope that people will not know that there are plans.
Since
we know that they have got plans.
They can't actually do it until this application is out of the way. They can't actually produce that plan.
Well, they could have done them before. I mean, they're
in the process. I'm afraid I put in the application when I did in order to stop them.
Well, they should start releasing
the plans. They're considering it. It's about preventing them from actually getting permission to do it.
Yes.
That's what we mean.
Your question next, then you afterwards. Okay.
Two questions. First thing, what you were just saying. It's a common opinion among some people that people only put in village green applications to hold up the planning process. Obviously there's a good reason for that. We want to hold up the planning process so that these these green spaces can be protected. But if they can't build on it while an application is in process, what would happen if just as that application gets refused, someone puts in another application?
That was one of your suggestions.
Yeah. If it's the same application, then I think, and it's already been decided on, then I think it can just be dismissed on paper without having to have a hearing.
Is that what, if someone just...
Because it's been decided. Yeah, they don't have to have a hearing. You can pressurise for a hearing, or they can just deal with it on paper. But if they've decided it, you may know more than this.
Yeah.
If they've decided it once already,
yeah.
and you put in exactly the same application again with the same information, then I think they can say, this has been decided, we're just dismissing it out of hand. But if you say, well, we're not applying for the whole of the land, but we're just applying for the western end of the land, then maybe, if there's reason behind it.
But I mean, they can always choose to only grant you green status on part of the land.
Hmm.
License to use land, is that the part of it that relates to, I mean, the language that they use is user by right or user as a right, isn't it?
That's it, yeah.
So how does that relate to the Castle Park? fairly straightforward, is it just that it doesn't have any fences that it's own for?
Well, they're trying to argue that it is use with their permission, because in 1978 they opened it as a park and invited the public to use it, and presumably at any time they could close it. But our case is that that's not happened. It's the actual wording of the case, the Sunderland case, which is less of a part than this, considers just this sort of situation. And talks about wood land that's not registered as a park but used as a park, and the council sort of talks about it being a park without it really being a park. Could that be a town green? And rather than answer that question, they say, well, we'll just have to deal with that when it arises. So it's completely undecided point of law, because town green applications have typically been about land that's never really been used for anything other than recreation.
Did you handle the Packers Field case?
No, I wish I had, but I passed over to all my friends who said he was helping them.
Why do you think, in a case like that, it looks as if they had just about as good a case as you could get, these things failed?
The law has changed on locality as well. When the Packers Field application, they were holding on to this very low-level court decisions that you had to, it had to be a very specific, defined locality.
Mm.
And very shortly after Packers Field application was lost, it went to the House of Lords again, and the House of Lords said, but that's nonsense, it doesn't make any sense at all in the modern world, because you don't have tiny villages hundreds of miles from other tiny villages, you have developments in and around and on top of each other.
So when they put that case in, were they obliged to say that it was either residents of Whitehall,
yeah,
Eastern or Greenbank?
So
they couldn't say what it saw.
Yeah. Whereas on this application, what we've said is that this is for the applicants of Bristol,
yeah,
or central Bristol.
Yeah. Because it is a park of main central importance to the whole of the city.
And they tried to pressurise, saying, give us a map drawing a line,
yes,
showing what is the locality. And we said, no.
Bristol, you know what Bristol is.
If you don't know what Bristol is, then you shouldn't be working for the council. Sorry.
On this point, I don't know whether I'm just a country, but in my family memory, I'm absolutely sure, the long-standing Bristolian family, I am quite sure at some point the smoke screen was burnt, but that this should be kept in permanent memorial. That's nobody's.
I'm sorry, did I not mention
not living in that area for all the obvious reasons, when all that the kind of population that lived around the old market, Castle Market was very important to generations of people, but because of those, particularly when Bristol City was being burned from Bath, and they said that's Bristol, White Plant, I'm sure that our family memory was that this would always be kept.
Well, Ben, I'm so sorry if I left that out. That was one of the reasons.
Maybe you mentioned it.
That was one of the reasons.
When you said the smoke,
yes, yes,
we'll about, you know, always believing it, you know, don't worry.
No. Will you give us a statement, please?
No.
We'll get your piece.
If you could put that in writing. And
of course, I always mean,
there is reference to it being a peace park.
Yes, I suspect
it's such a dramatic, traumatic time.
Yeah.
For people who were alive and who were on fire watch around that time, they always believed, I'm sure.
Yes, this is what I mean. Literature
up for having imagined it.
Yes.
So when you said, I'm sure I can remember.
I'm not absolutely certain of the Peace Park, actually, how big it was. Well, whether it was the whole, this is this problem.
Yeah.
Woolly edges.
Some people said, why didn't they just, because they took the Dutch house, and they could easily have rescued the Dutch house.
Yeah.
And within days, what was, it was a hit, but it wasn't by any means wiped out, they demolished it. So then families around said, well, what's happening to the church then?
Mm.
They said, they'll never touch it. It's sort of sacrosanct. It's got a very special memorial, not just to death,
yes,
but to those terrible nights.
Mm.
And I know the legal side of this, but there's something else going on here that is not quite being.
It would be very useful if you could help us with a statement on that, because it's this sort of almost folk memory that's so important for these applications, it helps a lot, and it also, you know, it really knocks through all this rhetoric you get from the council of this development's necessary to key in the city
and revive the historic quarter.
And there is the Civic Society's 1980 book, The Fight for Bristol, actually said that the council had bought the area, the bridge area, the Castle Park area, and had actually demolished existing buildings to make sure that the traders, the new mercantile people in Broadmead, did not suffer from competition from the old shopping area of Bristol.
Well, we don't want them to suffer competition.
Just thinking about all the things that have been discussed, Amy, would it make sense strategically from an individual paper this to basically find every bit of council run park, and if it's not actually an official park, why don't they declare the British Green now?
Because they aren't all under equal threat from development, and the whole point is that this one is very important. And we're focusing on it with all of the difficulties, because it is actually under impending threat, although everybody's being kept in the dark about it, and everybody prefers anyway not to think about things.
But if you have the energy, I think we should
do it. Yes. They are, I mean... Councillor, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to sort of come back on that and say that I've kind of thought about that recently myself, and every time I go to somewhere I kind of vaguely know, like when I go back to my hometown and I see bits of land that I used to play and I think that's going to get built on, that's how I see things now. And once you've got that perspective, you know, I kind of feel like leafleting those houses and saying, put it in, it might never happen, but you might as well do it. And I think there's a need for the Open Spaces website is very good. That's the people who kind of, you know, we know that help, you know, try and help people with town green applications. But what there needs to be is these campaigns need to be linked up. That's really important. Because it's not that, I mean, in some ways it's not that difficult to do. If you've got pre-made material and information on how to do stuff and what to tell people, it's just about distributing it. So I totally agree with you.
Yeah. The legislation is remarkably helpful as well, and the House of Lords has been remarkably helpful. In the Sunderland case, one of the members of the House of Lords was outraged this application was succeeding, basically by the council's default in doing anything proper about registering this land. And the other four law lords said, well, you know, that's what the law is. These people have applied for it to be registered. They've used it for more than 20 years. It's theirs.
Yeah. And one of the people trying to stop the railway park in turn of the floodplain, and it's like, whenever it happens, suddenly you're under so much pressure and schedule pressure, you just can't get your act together. Whereas now, when you're the greener and not yet under the hammer, that's when it's time to get your act together, really.
More time, there's no pressure on you,
you
can actually focus on it.
Paperwork
doesn't
mean
anything. Yeah. Kev, there's one thing that's in the back of my mind. How did you manage financially? Was a lot of expense involved?
Well, to be honest, in terms of the Town Green application, I didn't have a lot to do with that. That was when I was kind of first involved, and because I hadn't lived there a lot, you know, for long.
Yeah, I was wondering about expenses and things.
Everything's been kind of, you know, begged, borrowed, and probably stolen at some point. You know, it's all been self-funded, the occasional benefit night, you know. It's all self-funded. There's been no money taken from anywhere, but it's amazing what you can do.
Yeah. Just a little bit on this last discussion, really. One was, you mentioned one or two have gone to the House of Lords. I mean, that in itself seems quite an expensive process. And I mean, if this was to fall down in an argument, is this something you've got the House of Lords about when a park is not a park or what the boundaries are? And the second thing was in terms of this broader bit is almost taking your last point. I mean, I'm originally from Northampton. And they're actually now plans to build on the playing field where I used to be at the primary school, and my mum is partly part of the campaign now to put in a town green status application for the old school playing field that we used to put on. And I just sort of want, I mean, they've been in contact with Open Space, is it the Open Space Society? But I just, you know, I've got some stuff about Packersfield to send for now, so I've just...
Yeah, well, the application's free. The original application is free. The original hearing is no cost to anyone. And what you really need is either to do it yourself or get lawyers to do it for free for you.
Thank you, John.
I feel really angry with myself for not having got involved in Packersfield. I was new to Bristol at the time, and I was asked, could I help or did I know someone who could help? And I recommended someone who I thought was far more qualified than me to do it, and I presumed he was doing it, and then found out that he wasn't about a week before the hearing. Yeah, I think most of the other one, the two, the Oxford one and the Sunderland one, I presume it was just lawyers who were part of the campaign. You know, generally it's not a problem. I mean, it's, if you think that for an average lawyer it's going to take up, what, 1%, 2% of their annual time? Most people are interested, and more than people are giving up that sort of amount of time. You know, a House of Lords hearing is only actually a day. You know, you've got 250 working days in a year. It's not that hard to find, hopefully, people who are keen to do it. But if you've got anything in Bristol, I'm more than happy to draft your applications and do your hearings and stuff.
What about Salisbury? Do you have your help in Salisbury?
Yeah, go on.
Not until he's done anything in Bristol.
Yeah, no, I'll help in Salisbury.
We need your help as well. Doing the same there, to educate themselves.
Am I right in saying that the people who are going to decide on the Town Green application of the council?
I'm not sure. That's one of the objections we're raising.
I think this is Francis Horner, who is the recorder or the author or the register of Town Greens, is actually employed by the solicitors of part of the solicitors' office in legal services in the council house. As far as I know, she may very well sit on the next desk to the person who's written this magnificent
objection.
In the same room,
adjacent rooms. They close the door, throw
the. Therefore, I think she has to have at the very least, she has to have an inspector because the possibility of conflict of interest is so enormous.
I was trying to think of this subject as a whole and why it's so difficult to stop these things. And the main reason is that the way the council works is that they are in league with the developers. And they're trying as never before to make a profit on every bit of land in Bristol. There's probably something to do with central government policy in this. It's not entirely because they're all corrupt. But in fact, you know, they do things behind a mask of correct legal procedure. Mm-hmm. But actually, they have a clearly defined goal which they aim to get to no matter what. And although they may interpose various legal obstacles, they don't really respect the provisions of the law, they intend to get around them. So you have to be pretty clever, or you have to bring a whole lot of public pressure, or you have to find something about the nature of the relationships of the council to the developers
to have any hope. The council wants money because the council maintains that it chronically hasn't got enough money.
Therefore they want to sell off green
space land. And there's no doubt that Castle Park is prime estate.
Yeah, Wolf Springs.
Is it not possible that we could actually produce the argument which would get the council to start looking differently at these spaces? Because we have to win that overall moral argument that these spaces, you know, because you're deeply involved in this nuts and bolts rear guard action, stopping these things happening.
What we actually need to do is
win that whole big argument, which includes Stokes Croft, the Ashley Court Hotel, all the stuff that's going on up at Gloucester Road, and persuade the council, who are ultimately our elected members, who are supposed to do the will of what we
that
want.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, but we need to. That it seems to me that we need to win that argument or shame them into doing.
They do run scared, I think. You know, with a large number, big public reaction and a lot of stuff in the media. Yeah. They do withdraw, and then they go away and hide for a while, and out they come again. Yeah.
It's a problem because you can't do that through a legal process. You do that at the ballot box. The problem we've got is the three major parties are all essentially the same now. There's no opposition. You know, we've got right-wing Labour parties in power in the government and, you know, right-wing Liberal and Labour parties in power in councils across the country. And if it's not them, it's the Conservatives. There's no opposition. And that's why more than half the population don't vote. Because there's no one to vote for. If there was a party to vote for who was opposed to development of open spaces, then we might be able to do well.
There's a major election in Bristol in 2009, is it? Would it not be possible to start talking to each political party to find out what their views are on a specific subject?
It's really interesting, actually. There appears to be a dichotomy between the council, the council Labour Party, and the constituency Labour Party, because it's quite obvious what the council Labour Party are thinking of, and that's selling off sites for money, whereas Paul Smith, who is the Labour candidate for the next election, actually was marching on the towpath, not the towpath, the cycle path protest, and is very much in favour of retaining green spaces.
While he's looking for votes. One of my last campaigns when I was in London was the developments from Tower Bridge through to the Isle of Dogs through Wapping was the developments of all the river frontage with these tall flats. What it was doing was that you had all these low-rise council houses in the hearts of Wapping and the Isle of Dogs, and they were being isolated by the river, from the river, from all these huge private flats. And it got to the final strip of land, which was 200 metres wide, which was the last stretch of riverfront open to the public, on the whole of that stretch from Tower Bridge to the Isle of Dogs. And it went to judicial review, and in opposition, just before they were elected, John Prescott supported us enormously in the campaign. And we won the judicial review, the planning application was stopped, the developers put in a new application, Labour were elected, Prescott was put in charge at the Department of Environment Planning in the regions. He called the plan in and he approved it.
Oh. Wow.
And the land was built on, and there is now no access to the riverfront from Tower Hill through to the Isle of Dogs.
At least
just things like this need to be known amongst the public here. You know, this oxygen of publicity of this low level corruption is going on throughout this city and elsewhere in the country. And it does seem to me that we need to be winning the media over putting out these messages to shame our elected members into behaving more reasonably.
Well, it's actually corruption at all levels. But, you know, John Prescott actually implemented, I think, a policy drive with all local governments to consider making as big a profit as they could on the land in their region. So this is part of the national policy, and by making Prescott the Deputy Prime Minister, he was obviously seduced with all the things that go with it to support all of these policies, otherwise he wouldn't have taken the job. So that's what he is. He's somebody who gives an appearance of standing for the common people, and he doesn't. So that's what they do.
Regarding the borough class stuff, Paul Smith being supported, but so has the Labour MP from Bristol East as well, whatever her name is. So, supported. But we've also had a suggestion from somebody who's more politically astute than us, that there's something levelled with politics in these campaigns. And he's pointed out, if you get 20,000 signatures by petition, the council is obliged to hold a referendum to should it have a democratically elected mayor. Now, we're not quite sure that your own Boris Johnson is really a selling point for the future, but it sounds like it would be. But it would be interesting, once you actually start being a single elected mayor, you could actually have more chance to have kind of policies like no more open green space in there, rather than political parties which are more beholden to kind of national interests.
Well, the mayor is beholden to business interests. I mean, Ken Livingstone did an enormous amount of privatising, and nevertheless, wanted as bad as possible. They work for business interests. Yeah. You know, it's not just corruption, it's our whole system.
We've got to fit in another talk about Stokes Croft and Old Market. So, last few comments.
Yeah. First of all, if anyone's interested in the Castle Park campaign, we meet every other Thursday at the
Naval
Volunteer. So we're meeting next Thursday. Or if you'd just like to give a name and address, maybe, so we could contact you if there's something happening, it'd be really good. We're only a small group. And the other thing is George Ferguson, who's the architect they've brought in to design the design for the park development, is speaking on the 14th of May, so that's next Wednesday, I think, at 7:30 to 9 o'clock at the Watershed. And he's speaking on regeneration by design. So it would be good. I mean, it's £6. I don't think I'm going to pay to go in, but I'm certainly going to be outside with a banner and, you know.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary.